Docket number 84277 and clustered with 84278. Washoe County Human Services Agency versus District Court. Counsel, are you ready to proceed on this one?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And did you want to reserve time on this one as well?
Yes, please. I have 5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, and may it please the court, Erin Morgan, on behalf of petitioner Washoe County Human Services Agency. NRS 128.109(1A) and 2 are constitutional. While the underlying matters have resolved, the capable of repetition yet evading review exception to the mootness doctrine applies to the issue presently before this court. This is certainly a matter of widespread importance that is important to all participants in termination of parental rights actions brought by Nevada child welfare agencies, including children, parents, and the child welfare agencies. As demonstrated by petitioner's appendices, the district court is wildly inconsistent in its application of the rebuttable presumptions, as well as its weighty determination that the rebuttable presumptions are unconstitutional. In some instances, the district court refuses to apply the rebuttable presumptions based on the erroneous conclusion that they are unconstitutional. And despite making this weighty determination and undermining its own order, the district court applies the rebuttable presumptions in its consideration of terminating other parents' rights. This district court's order also creates an inconsistency throughout the state where other jurisdictions are relying on NRS 128.109(1A) and 2. Resolution of this issue is important to ensure consistency in the application of valid Nevada law throughout the entire state, not only in Washoe County. And there's a high likelihood that this issue, the same exact issue, will continue to arise in Washoe County as the Washoe County Alternate Public Defender's Office continues to file these pretrial motions and actions brought by petitioner.
Counsel, what is the evidence in this record that the judge is applying the rebuttable presumptions in one way in some cases and other ways in other cases?
Yes, Your Honor. I would direct you to Petitioner's Appendix 168 through 195,
okay.
And specifically docket number 84278. And those orders, the parents did not contest the petition, did not come to contest the petition, and the district court applied the presumptions. And then in the former half of the appendice would be the orders in which the district court did not apply the presumptions based on this erroneous conclusion that they are unconstitutional.
But other than those two examples, you use the term wildly inconsistent, which infers to me that we're talking about more than a couple of cases here. Are there other examples that are in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. There are examples in petitioner's reply appendices, and I just apologize. I don't have the exact sites.
I'll go back and take it.
But there are other examples in which the district court is applying the presumptions, although it has found them unconstitutional in other actions.
So this is inconsistencies by a judge who handles this docket.
And yes.
It's, you're saying the inconsistencies are occurring by this particular judge in the handling of the docket, but are there examples in the record about how that is inconsistent with how the rest of the district courts are handling this subject in the rest of the state?
I don't have any examples specifically from the other jurisdictions throughout Nevada. However, I am unaware of any examples of another district court judge finding these statutes unconstitutional and precluding other participants in these termination actions from using these statutes. And the duration of the challenged action is short because the district court is statutorily obligated to conclude to make its best efforts to conclude these proceedings within 6 months. So for all of these reasons, petitioner would request that this court consider the petition on the merits. And now moving to the merits of the petition, looking at these rebuttable presumptions in context, it would be impossible for the district court to terminate parental rights based on the mere application of these rebuttable presumptions. And in Enrage ADN, this court already determined that the presumptions, the rebuttable presumptions, meet the procedural due process requirements outlined by the United States Supreme Court in Santosky. And the district court plainly disregarded this court's decision.
I'm sorry, counsel. Where did JDN address the procedural due process?
Yes, Your Honor. In Enrage ADN, this court looked at the three Matthews versus Eldridge factors. And
Yes, okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you. And so the district court plainly disregarded this court's conclusion in Enrage ADN. And this court got it right, not only for the reasons outlined in Enrage ADN, but for other reasons. Again, and looking at the statutory scheme, it would be impossible for a district court to terminate parental rights based on the mere application of the presumptions. And the district court concluded otherwise, erroneously concluded otherwise for several reasons. NRS 128.105 requires the district court to consider the factors in 107 and 108 prior to terminating a parent's rights. There is nothing in Chapter 128 to suggest that these mandatory statutory findings are no longer required merely because the presumptions apply. Coming to this conclusion would render the entirety of the termination of parental rights statutory scheme nugatory. For example, in the examples that I pointed out in petitioner's appendix at 168 through 195 in docket number 84278, even when a parent does not show up to contest the petition to terminate parents' rights, the petitioner is required to present evidence sufficient to prove by clear and convincing evidence all the factors necessary to terminate a parent's rights. The factors in 107 and 108 are also directly relevant to the parental fault ground of token efforts and the best interest determination, which this court has acknowledged on several occasions in upholding district court orders terminating parents' rights.
Counsel, if we were to agree with your analysis, how would you approach our assessment of a case like Florida Department of Children and Families and the determination made in that case that parental rights may be terminated only if the state proves involuntary termination and found the rebuttable presumptions to be unconstitutional?
In that specific instance, the Florida court was actually looking at it was not a rebuttable presumption. The lower court had created a rebuttable presumption. And so in that case, the lower court did not require additional evidence beyond that involuntary termination to be presented by petitioner. However, Nevada's statutory scheme does not allow petitioner to just present one single fact, which would be the time and care, and to rest their case and then prevail. Mm-hmm. Our statutory scheme in Nevada requires more than just the mere time and care being presented. And going towards the factors in 107, this court has stated that the district court must, in Enrage ADN, this court stated that the district court must consider the factors in 107 prior to terminating a parent's rights. The factors in 107 include the needs and desires of the child, the efforts made by the parents, including visitation, the services offered, and what additional services would likely allow that child to reunify in a predictable period. And the factors regarding the parental fault ground of token efforts include token efforts to support or communicate with their child, which includes visitation, and token effort. The other factors for token efforts include token efforts to avoid being an unfit parent, prevent the neglect of the child, or prevent the risk of harm or injury. And those are directly relevant to the 107 factors of what efforts the parents have made, the services offered, and what additional services that would likely bring about lasting parental adjustment. And finally, with respect to the 108 factors, those are directly relevant to the best interest determination because they look at the child's love and emotional ties with the natural parents and the prospective adoptive parents, how long the child has been in that home, and whether they've become an integrated member of the family. If there are no questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Dominic Sennett. I'm with the Washoe County Alternate Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing the parent real parties in interest today. May it please the court. This court has repeatedly held that the termination of parental rights is akin to the civil death penalty. NRS 128-109-1A are unconstitutional because they are based solely on the passage of time. They are mandatory, and they shift the whole burden of proof. In addition to that, 108-129-2 proves the main consideration in a termination of parental rights case, that of the best interest of the child. Without these statutes as written, a child welfare agency is not precluded from arguing with the trial or from presenting to the trial court that the passage of time should be considered, both in a parental fault analysis and a best interest analysis. That would give the trial court discretion to determine what is actually in the best interest of the child, and the trial court is in the best position to make those determinations. In this case, the trial court's conclusion rests on, was informed by, a careful balancing of the competing interests in this case, a careful analysis of the Nevada statutes and Nevada case law, and an examination from authority from other jurisdictions. Both of the underlying cases in this matter have been dismissed. It is our position that these cases are moot. The agency, in fact, has an adequate remedy of law, which would be to go to a trial where these statutes have been declared unconstitutional, lose at trial, and then appeal the decision. As noted in petitioner's appendices, in all of the cases where this statute had been declared unconstitutional that went to trial, they were successful in terminating parental rights. Therefore, they have no actual injury. And in addition to that, children have not been delayed towards permanency because the cases took their normal route. This is an issue of statewide import, and as such, this court has complete discretion to hear it on a writ matter, but we do believe the cases are moot. NRS 128-109 are time-based, they're mandatory, and they shift the full burden of proof, not just the burden of production, to the parents. And they prove by presumption parental fault and the best interest of the child. These statutes were intended to do so, as can be seen from the legislative history. The presumptions under NRS 128-109, 1A and 2 are harder to rebut than other presumptions in civil litigation, as noted in INRI JDN and Rivera v. Philip Morris. In addition to that, the statute itself limits the type of evidence a parent can show to rebut the presumption. And Justice Hardesty, you brought up an excellent point, because the failure to provide reasonable efforts during the phase of the case could obviously extend the time that a parent could reunify. Other causes for delay, not just the not providing reasonable efforts, but a caseworker is overburdened. and the case doesn't get as much time as it should. It could easily extend the life of the case longer than the 14 months.
But that doesn't make the reasonable effort statute unconstitutional, but it could influence the constitutionality of the termination statute.
Correct, Your Honor. It is just one example that why should it be on a parent to prove this is the reason they didn't reunify with their child? Under the Nevada statutory scheme, it is the agency's responsibility to prove by clear and convincing evidence each element that is required, and that's parental fault and best interest of the child. Now, other possible ways a case could be delayed are the lack of services. We have a lack of services in Nevada, and the inability for a parent to get services is very difficult to show at trial. It's very difficult to prove a negative. And given the statutory scheme, why should a parent have to prove that was the reason that that the statute should not apply?
Well, how do we view the inverse of that? So there's not services, given, appreciated. So how long does a child have to be in limbo because there aren't services? Where do we balance the state interest in the child's end of this transaction?
Yes, and Justice Stiglitz, the argument on real parties and interests is not that the child's best interest should not be taken into account. That is, under NRS 128.105, which was amended at the same time 129 was enacted, requires that the best interest of the child be taken into account. Removing these statutes does not change the focus on the best interest of the child. It changes who has the burden of proof to show the reasons why the case has taken so long. And given the Matthews v. Eldridge factors in Santosky v. Kramer, with regards to the risk of erroneous deprivation and the possibility of additional procedural safeguards, additional procedural safeguards in this case is removing the mandatoriness of this statute. And as noted in petitioners, under the filings in the underlying case and in this case, there would be no additional government resources if the statutes were removed, which is the third prong of the Matthews v. Eldridge test. And that's noted in the record.
Mr. Senate, Ms. Morgan made the argument that we should undertake this case because of the six-month time frame. But you're saying that this could be handled by direct appeal. Do I have the arguments correct here?
I believe that there is a legal remedy in this case, Your Honor.
What say you with regard to the concern expressed by Ms. Morgan that this six-month time frame compels a review of the constitutionality of this statute rather than by direct appeal? Just reflecting on this and having heard some of the things that you've mentioned, it seems there's a lot of fact-driven stuff here. We might be better having full records in considering this on appeal rather than by writ, but I wanted to get your take on the timing concerns she expressed.
No, Justice Hardesty, the issue that I see there is in real parties and interests estimation, there are families, both parents and children, being injured by an unconstitutional statute every day. And therefore, the review by this court would be appropriate given that issue. But with regard to the six-month time period, I think this is something that is possible to evade review, potentially. However, I do think, realistically, it's not very likely that the agency loses a case when it goes to trial. So if we wait and wait for that to go to trial, I don't know when this would be heard on appeal, to be quite candid.
Isn't that some evidence that the presumptions are appropriate, that the legislature made an appropriate analysis in deciding if there's this much time, then we can presume that the fault factor and the best interest of a child would warrant termination?
Well, I think that could be seen two ways. One, it could be that the deck was stacked so against the parents that they lost at trial. We don't have evidence as to what happened or the burden of proof that was shown there. The evidence that we do have in front of this court is when the statutes were declared unconstitutional and the agency was unable to use them, they were still successful at trial. So that's evidence to show that these statutes are not necessary for what the agency is suggesting that they are.
Right. Did it take longer than it would have otherwise?
Not that I know of.
What's the impact then, one way or the other, on whether they're able to use the presumption or not?
So That is a difficult question to answer, Justice Kadish. But the evidence that we have is that without the presumption, the agency has suffered no harm and kids have not suffered any delay in permanency. And so it is the argument that even without the presumptions, there's no delay and there's